Good afternoon, and welcome everyone to Arsenic Health and Remediation Applications Internet Web Seminar Series. This is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. This is the first session titled Emerging Issues, Arsenic Exposures. I'm Bill Sook, and I'm director of the Superfund Research Program at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, or NIEHS. We're going to get started in a few minutes. While we wait for the others to log on, I am going to need to cover a few housekeeping items. So bear with me while I go through this before we get on, okay? When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note the presenters' email address are hot linked on that page in case you have any question after today's presentation. For those of you joining us by the telephone lines, your phones were placed on mute when you joined the call. We will have question and answers set. We will have a question and answer sessions at each point you can take your phone off mute. We ask that that phone participants keep their phones on mute during the question and answer session unless you are asking a question. To unmute your phone during the question and answer session, you will need to dial *7. You may also need to press your phone's mute button if you previously put yourself on mute. After you ask your question, please place your phone back on mute by pressing *6 or by using your phone's mute button. Again, *6 to mute, *7 to unmute. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can interrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Excuse me. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music, you know, elevator music, or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. By now, those of you participating via the phone line should have the presentation open and should be on *1. All of those participating via the internet should have clicked on the quote go to session end quote icon near the bottom of the page and should be on *1 of the presentation. As explained on *2, the main page contains the slides above which you will find navigation icons. Internet participants may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide and need not wait until the question and answer period to submit a question. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the question and answer session. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we will help you troubleshoot the problem. The presenter will be announcing the number of slides to which they are moving. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow location above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. At the end of the presentations, we will walk you through our links page where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery of the presentations, delivery mechanisms. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so that you can access it after the presentations. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. In the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations that they were given today. Past seminars are available on the Kluwen website and are also accessible via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Program, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information or Kluwen archives. With that, we are ready to start the session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute, and again, do not put us on hold. Before introducing the moderator and first presenter for today's session, I'd like to give a brief introduction. The Superfund Research Program, in collaboration with the Environmental Protection Agency, started the Risk e-Learning webinar series in October 2002. This month marks the 10th anniversary. Since 2002, we have conducted 46 Risk e-Learning webinars, with a total attendance reaching 10,000. Arsenic and arsenic health effects have been studied by SRP researchers since the beginning of the program. One center that joined the SRP in 2000 has been conducting substantial arsenic research at Superfund sites, as well as unique epidemiologic studies of arsenic-exposed adults and adolescents residing in Bangladesh. The first presenter today and the moderator for the rest of this session is Dr. Joseph Graziano. He's director of the Columbia University Superfund Research Program. Dr. Graziano's research career has been devoted to understanding the consequences of exposure to metals, both on the molecular and the population levels. Human exposure to metals occurs via a number of different scenarios that include exposure in the workplace, in the home, such as lead paint, or arsenic in drinking water, or outdoors, due to airborne emissions from industry or transportation vehicles. In the past, Dr. Graziano's research has almost entirely devoted to lead poisoning, which has contributed to understanding the adverse effects of lead exposure on childhood development. As a pharmacologist, his laboratory developed the oral drug that is now used to treat children with lead poisoning. More recently, Dr. Graziano's work has taken him to Bangladesh, where his current research is aimed at understanding the consequences of arsenic exposure on the Bangladeshi population and on devising strategies to reduce toxicity and provide arsenic-free drinking water, a problem that spans beyond the political borders of Bangladesh to much of Southeast Asia, from India to Vietnam. Recent findings that both arsenic and manganese, both elevated in Bangladesh drinking water, are associated with cognitive deficits in children add urgency to solving this enormous public health and environmental problem. Dr. Graziano, I will now turn the time over to you. Joe?
Thank you, Bill. And thank you for the invitation to present today and to moderate this session. So I'm going to direct the participants to slide number 4 and begin to give an overview of the arsenic public health problem, and I dare say people who are tuned into this already know much of what's on this slide. Arsenic is a known carcinogen with cancers of lung, liver, skin, bladder, and so forth. What's newer and interesting and a topic of more research lately is the consequences of early life exposures to arsenic and the consequences later in life experienced as adults. And I'll touch on that a bit later. Multiple potential health effects occur. Virtually no organ system goes unscathed, and we're probably all aware of the skin lesions, lung, cardiovascular disease, endocrine, and so forth. And today I'm going to touch a bit on the cardiovascular disease effects because that's a relatively new body of knowledge emerging from work in Bangladesh and elsewhere. And finally, on slide four, ATSDR rates arsenic as number one on the substance priority list as the top chemical of concern and a public health hazard. So let's go to slide five. As Bill alluded to, the history of arsenic as a topic of concern for the Superfund research program dates back to the inception of the program in 1987. And the SRP has taken a comprehensive approach to investments in research and development, investments in detection systems, remediation strategies, identifying and reducing exposures, a great deal of work on the health effects and the mechanisms of the health effects. And the SRP has also been very active in training the next generation of scientists and community partners. And as you probably know, the SRP involves interaction with community and government. And this is the one program that I know of, funding source, that not only encourages but requires interaction and collaboration between biomedical scientists and non-biomedical scientists. In that regard, it is really very unique. So I'll move to slide six just to summarize. Research goes back to 87. Currently, there are 19 SRP research centers involved in Superfund research, many of which have arsenic-related projects. And as evidence of the productivity, since 2006, there have been more than 150 peer-reviewed scientific papers in the literature. So slide seven, just to reiterate, the work has focused on sources of contamination, on characterization of the toxic arsenic species, this is something I'll dwell on today, and biomarkers of exposure. It's worked on identifying the health effects and the mechanisms of toxicity, on exploring ways to mitigate health effects, both through engineering efforts and other strategies in the biomedical area. It's engaged communities and government, as we're doing today, and stakeholders in solving the real problems on the ground, and has trained many, many scientists in this field. So I'll go to slide eight and spend a minute or two here. It's an important slide, and it lists the various metabolites of arsenic that can occur in the human body. So if we could take a urine sample or a blood sample to the laboratory, we can actually measure the amounts of each and every one of these metabolites in blood or urine. And, of course, what comes out of the ground in South Asia is arsenite, the arsenic plus three. We'll talk about work in Chile where the problem is surface water. It's river water, and there the exposure is arsenate, arsenic plus five. And actually the phenotypes of associated with exposures to these differ a bit, although they're interchangeable in vivo. Once we absorb a dose of arsenic, it goes to liver, where the liver can actually methylate and then add a second methyl group to form MMA, the monomethyl species, or DMA, the dimethyl species. And these can occur in the trivalent or pentavalent form. And finally, if we look in human urine or blood, we can find other metabolites, the so-called fish metabolites or dietary metabolites. These are arsenocholine, which essentially has three methyl groups, and arsenobetaine, which has four methyl groups. And I refer you to the numbers on the right side. This refers to the relative toxicity of these compounds, the so-called lethal dose in 50% of, in this case, mice. And you can see that they vary enormously in their relative acute toxicity, with the inorganic species having small numbers. Then you notice there are two forms of the monomethyl, one of which, the trivalent, is extraordinarily toxic, at least in cell culture and in animal models, with an LD50 of only 2 milligrams per kilogram. And then you go on to see that the oxidized monomethyl and, for that matter, the dimethyl are far less toxic, The dimethyl, we'll talk a lot about the LD50, 648 milligrams per kilogram. So way, way less toxic than inorganic or that trivalent monomethyl. And finally, the fish metabolites. You can literally eat them by the spoonful. The LD50 is in excess of 10 grams per kilo. They are not toxic whatsoever. So we'll come back to this. And one area of controversy some years back was, is methylation a good thing or a bad thing? Because in order to get to the dimethyl form, you see you have to go through this very, very toxic intermediate. And basically the epidemiology says very clearly that if you are a good methylator and can get to the dimethyl form, you are far less risk for developing disease. And I've added to the bulletin board, if you will, some more information on this, and I'll come back to that. Slide 9, what have we learned? Well, arsenic exists in the Earth's crust, and in some parts of the Earth it becomes soluble, in other parts it doesn't. We are exposed to industrial sources. There have been some issues with CCA-treated wood. That's chromated copper arsenate-treated wood. It's my understanding that EPA has reviewed this, and it's approved on a limited basis, but not for use in homes, decking, or playgrounds and this kind of thing. There are other rarer sources like homeopathic remedies. But today's three presentations, I think it's fair to say, are in the bottom. I'll be focusing on drinking water. Margaret Karagas will be discussing, among other things, diet and exposures from rice. And Eduardo Saez will be talking about some dust issues. We'll go to slide 10. This problem is truly a global problem. WHO estimates that 140 million people across 70 countries are exposed to arsenic from drinking water alone. And I think it's fair to say if we go back 15 years ago and look at the countries on the left, much of what we knew about the health, adverse health effects of arsenic came from Taiwan, where they switched to an arsenic-contaminated source in the early 40s, and from Chile, where they switched to a river, they diverted a river that was rich in arsenic to amplify their drinking water source. And so these epidemics are long-standing, have had since been resolved in both cases. But 15 years ago, we relied heavily on knowledge from those two countries, as well as some others listed there. The current problems, I dare say, are on the right side of this slide. The countries on the right.
This is Eduardo. I was disconnected from the call.
Where
the phone line had a problem.
UNICEF went in to India, Bangladesh, the lowlands of Nepal, and eventually Vietnam, and installed well water as a means of getting away from microbially contaminated surface water that was associated with diarrheal disease and infant mortality. And so this is where a great deal of work has emerged and has informed us over the past decade. And in some parts of the world, concentrations reached 3,000 micrograms per liter, or ppb, as compared to the 10 micrograms per liter, which is the U.S. EPA MCL level. Let me go to slide 11 just to touch on the United States, and we'll come back when Margaret Karagas presents in the third presentation. This just downloaded from the U.S. Geological Survey website and shows you the hot spots in the United States, many of which are actually currently treated water supplies and so are not exposing populations, although the arsenic pre-exists in the groundwater. But in some parts of this map, people still rely on well water that is naturally rich in arsenic. And today we're going to focus on New England. Margaret Kragas will talk about her work in New Hampshire, and I'll briefly touch on our work in Maine, where we do both geochemistry and health effects work. Let me go to slide 12. So the activities funded by the Superfund research program include, for example, the two large cohort studies that I'll talk about today, ours in Bangladesh and Alan Smith's sort of retrospective cohort in Alan Smith from UC Berkeley, working with co-investigators in Chile. This is an exposure that's in the past, but is yielding a great deal of information. Studies in the U.S. have identified and reduced exposures, identified health effects, mechanisms of toxicity, and have explored approaches to mitigating toxicity. And action has been taken at the local level, and I'll touch on this and what we at Columbia have been involved with both in Bangladesh and in Maine to help provide safe, arsenic-free sources of drinking water. I'll go to slide 13 and start to drill down on these two large studies. The first one, the so-called health effects and launch of arsenic, should have of arsenic and longitudinal study, or what we call the HEALS study. I'll get to that more in a moment. We study thousands of people measuring exposure at the level of the individual. And then there's the Chilean cohort, which is really ecologic epidemiology, comparing disease rates in one part of the country that was arsenic exposed to disease rates in another part of the country that was not exposed. And here again, that population, we know the day the exposure started in the early 1950s, when the arsenic-containing river was provided as a water supply, and we know the day, basically the day it ended, some four decades later. And this is a unique example in environmental health where we know the day things started and the day it ended, and so that's been a very useful experiment of nature, so to speak. Slide 14, if you will, is some data that from the HEAL study, from the work in Bangladesh, 9,300 of the 12,000 participants. Here's their urinary arsenic on the y-axis and well water, household well water on the x-axis. And there are two points I'd like to make here. First, if you look at the range of the well water arsenic concentrations, you see what we are dealing with in Bangladesh, at levels up to 900 micrograms per liter. But at the same time, we designed this study so as to have a great deal of statistical power in the low end of this exposure range, knowing full well that this could provide information of relevance to the United States. What you see is this correlation between well water arsenic and urinary arsenic is kind of sloppy. The correlation is 0.5. On the other hand, if we limit this analysis to those people who said, I drink all of my water from this well, that correlation tightens up to about 0.7. Obviously, men who go off and work in the fields and will have access to other water sources, and so there's always some slippage in that parameter. But another reason for this scatter of this relationship, we now know, relates to the fact that people vary enormously in their ability to methylate arsenic, and that dimethyl form of arsenic is the form that is more readily eliminated into urine. So if you are a good arsenic methylator, you will eliminate a higher fraction of that dose than if you are a poor methylator. And if we look at the percentage of the total urine that is dimethyl in the subset of this population, we see it varies from 20% to 95%, and the average is about 70. So This is critically important because we now know that those who are poor methylators are at higher risk, and I refer you to a paper that I posted and a slide that I posted as supplemental materials. Let's go to slide 15 and discuss now one health outcome that we're all interested in, and that's death. And so here in the gray boxes, we see the timeline of this prospective study of initially 12,000 adults, what is now in excess of 20,000 adults. And so that gray baseline box represents the year 2000, when we recruited 12,000 adults between 18 and 65 years of age. Here my colleague, Dr. Habib Al-Hassan, a physician epidemiologist, is the principal investigator of this project in the Columbia program. And we have followed those 12,000 people now several times. Basically, the follow-ups are 2 years apart. So you see follow-ups in gray 1, 2, and 3. And you see above the gray box the number of deaths that were ascertained at each of those. And so we have a total of 407 deaths occurring through the first roughly 6 years. And that's what I would like to discuss with you today. Those 407 deaths, if you look at the bottom blue sentence, a verbal autopsy was used to classify each of those deaths, a validated autopsy, using WHO's ICD-10 code. So let's go to the next slide, 16, which is a little busy. This manuscript is posted so that you can have access to it after this presentation. But it's not as difficult as it may look. Let's look at the left side, arsenic exposure. And below that, we look at three metrics of arsenic exposure. We've looked at well water arsenic. We've looked at the daily arsenic dose ingested in micrograms per day. And we've looked at urinary arsenic. And in each case, these are the values on the day the person was recruited into the study in the year 2000. The bottom two are by quartiles. The top two, you see, we use as a reference arsenic less than 10. And in each case, the lowest group is assigned a hazard ratio of 1. They're the reference group. So if we move one column to the right, we see the number of deaths that occurred in each of those groups. In each case, they add up to 407. And if we move one more column to the right, we see under all-cause mortality, this is any cause of death, whether it's disease-related, an accident, anything, what you see under the hazard ratio, which is essentially equivalent to like a relative risk, in comparison to the lowest exposure group, you see something slightly resembling a dose-response curve. Certainly, those with the highest exposure for each of these three metrics have significantly higher all-cause mortality. But of those 407 deaths, 311 of them, if we move to the right and look at chronic disease mortality, 311 of them are people who died of chronic diseases. And in this case, you see a much clearer dose-response relationship with each and every metric, whether it's water arsenic, daily dose, or urinary arsenic. And so we see here definitely an increased risk as a function of the arsenic concentration in this medium. I'll go on to say we've done additional work here, and here again I've posted a paper. First author is Yu Chen, who's now at NYU, but a former PhD student here. Much of this chronic disease mortality is cardiovascular disease. In fact, 43% of the deaths are due to cardiovascular disease, and Yu Chen has followed this out beyond the 6 years. And if anything, this is a surprise. We know arsenic is a carcinogen, and yet here the major killer in the Bangladesh cohort is actually myocardial infarction related to arsenic in a dose-dependent fashion. Let's go to slide 17. So I mentioned earlier early life exposures. We're learning more and more about the problems of early life exposures, in particular prenatal exposure, which is associated with increased infant mortality, lower birth weight, increased infections in early childhood. My own group's work has uncovered neurologic problems both in intelligence and motor function, and there's some evidence of even cancer and evidence, as I'll show you in a moment, of increased cancer in adulthood due to exposure early in life. Let's go to slide 18. So, for example, from the work in Chile, Alan Smith and his co-workers at UC Berkeley and in Chile have this unique opportunity. So if recall that the exposure in Chile ended essentially on a given day, not exactly, but a treatment plant was installed and people were put on piped water. And so using birth certificates, he could examine those births who were born just after the treatment plant went in. So he can identify from birth certificates those who had exposure just in utero and in early childhood. And he can also use death certificates and link them to go back and look at the increases in mortality. And in fact, he has linked exposure in utero and in early childhood to increased mortality from lung cancer and a non-malignant lung disease, bronchiectasis, and basically groups around the world see all forms of non-malignant lung disease. And so this is just one piece, and there are many pieces of evidence that indicate that early life exposures cause you to pay a price later in life. Let's go to slide 19, and I would like to sort of close by showing you how we have tried to make a difference, both in our work in Bangladesh and in our work in Maine. In Bangladesh, we started, you know, we realized, of course, we can't just study people. This can't be the natural history of arsenic poisoning. And so we set out to provide various forms of low arsenic water. Most successful has been the program drilling deep wells. It turns out that arsenic concentration is related to well depth, and there is a deep aquifer that is essentially arsenic-free. And so we began by providing 150 villages with deep community wells that provide low arsenic water to thousands of residents. And seeing the success of this, UNICEF and the government of Bangladesh actually recruited one of our geochemists who was involved with this, Dr. Yan Zhang, who went and spent 2 years working with them on the expanding the deep well program. And there are now in excess in Bangladesh of 20,000 deep wells that are providing low arsenic water to many, many thousands. We also, as Bill Sook saw in a visit to Bangladesh, we provide medical care, primary medical care, to more than 20,000 participants in this cohort study. If I go to slide 20, it's a photo of a celebration surrounding the installation of a deep well. This particular well is 800 feet. Yes, it's red, but in fact it's now painted green. The manufacturer, you know, manufactured it as red. But in fact, this well is accessible to everyone in the village, and so on average, 700 or 800 people have access to one of these deep wells. Go to the next slide, 21. We're celebrating the installation of a deep well at a school, and to our astonishment, even as late as 2005 and 6, mind you, this epidemic was identified in the early 90s. Many schools had wells at the school with water arsenic concentrations in the 300, 400, 500. Microgram per liter range. We've also done a randomized trial, a PhD student project, a Bangladeshi student project. We've given many schools good wells, and half of the schools got arsenic-related education in the classroom, and half did not. And essentially what this project demonstrated is that 1 year after giving everybody access to good water, and in fact not only at the school but at their homes in their villages, kids who got education in the school had lower, significantly lower urinary arsenic concentrations, which really tells us that the wells are being used. And it's interesting, it tells us that giving kids education, that knowledge filters back up to their mothers who are the ones who actually fetch the water. Next, we'll go to slide 22. Part of that education program includes, for example, school art contests, and we've had 50 schools involved in art contests. This little girl is holding her artwork that shows in the center a man with skin lesions on his back, and shows a green and red well and so forth. And we have the winners in each of 50 schools have a final playoff, if you will. Let me go to slide 23. What are we doing in Maine? Well, we've established a community engagement core that disseminates knowledge about the hazards of local well water arsenic concentration, contamination, and disseminates information about technologies to filter arsenic. Slide 24 shows you Yan Zheng's work. She's done fundamental geochemistry and improved the mapping of arsenic in Maine. Here you see that 31% of the wells tested exceeded 10 micrograms per liter. And if I go to slide 25, here Jan has used the 2000 census to illustrate that, and if you look in the lower left, 12,500 people are exposed to arsenic higher than 10 ppb, and that includes 3,200+ children exposed to high arsenic. And my own work, we're just wrapping up a study. Let me go back, if I may. Let me go back to slide 24. You see in slide 24 there are some, on the map, there are some blue flags. These are elementary schools that have been involved in a study of the relationship between arsenic exposure and child intelligence, a relationship that we've described many times over now in Bangladesh. And I'm basically embargoed from talking about the results of this work in Maine, but Yan Zheng's work set the stage for that. So I'll jump ahead now to slide 26 and in the home stretch here. This is the situation as of a few years ago in Bangladesh. The pie chart, you see 57% still exposed. That number is decreasing continually now with this deep well drilling program. Back in 2006, only 12% in the dark blue were drinking deep well water, but that piece of the pie is increasing every day. And finally, my last slide is an acknowledgement. Bill Sook visited Bangladesh in July. We had a symposium and then a day in the field, and unfortunately the day in the field, it was rainy season, and here we are trying to stay dry with to no avail, holding banana leaves, the local form of umbrellas here. So I will stop here and open up this session for questions and discussion. And if we could, we can go to the phones first. And again, I'll remind you to, if you want to present a question, you need to do *7 to unmute, and I'll be glad to hear from you. Anyone on the phones?
Hi, this is Mike Ruby. Can you hear me?
Yes, Mike. Can you identify your affiliation and your name?
Yes. Mike Ruby, Integral Consulting. I have a question for you, which is, given everything that is being learned about arsenic toxicity and the mechanisms of carcinogenesis, what is your best kind of understanding about the shape of the dose response curve at low doses, so 0 to 10 micrograms per liter, and whether the evidence currently points to a linear or a threshold-type dose response curve in that range?
Well, that's a very good question, and in fact, will be the topic of a committee and EPA is putting their heads together. So EPA is interested in revisiting the information on the IRIS website concerning the cancer slope factor, and has Congress has commissioned the National Academy to put together an NRC committee to re-examine the issue of carcinogenicity and the slope factor, and so I'm going to punt on this, Mike, and just tell you that this committee will convene for the first time sometime in January at a date yet to be specified. So there will be a great deal of attention to that issue in the coming year.
Okay, thank you.
I'll go to a question on the that I have here coming in from participants who are on the internet. A question from Mark Stifleman, EPA, Seattle. basically, would you expect to find MMA3 in fish tissue? And here, I'm quite sure the answer is no. The predominant species of arsenic in fish are the betaine, arsenobetaine, and some arsenocholine. And so I would not expect, unless they're living in a totally arsenic-contaminated environment, I would not expect to see arsenic MMA plus 3 in fish tissue. Do we have another question on the phone? If not, I have a question from Jason Bridges from Amherst, lata.com. Regarding the U.S. map, what did you say were the sources of arsenic in these areas? Natural, mostly, industry? Natural. Certainly in New England, the sources are seams of arsenic in the bedrock. And the wells in New England are drilled into the bedrock, and one can actually visualize seams that contain iron oxides and arsenate in the bedrock. I'm less sure about the southwest, but indeed they are natural sources, and largely I can't say that it's true of 100%, but they are largely anthropogenic. Do we have a question on the phone?
Yes, this is Alex McDonald. I'm with the Regional Water Quality Control Board here in Sacramento, California. And is arsenic something that we should be concerned with accumulation in crops? And the arsenic exposure, is it mostly concerned with water exposure versus food exposure?
Yes, so this will be a topic that Margaret Karagas will touch on in the third presentation. So if I may, I'm going to hold off on
sure.
that.
Okay, thank you.
Question for now. I have a question on the screen here. Martha Hankins, Washington Department of Ecology, Lacey, Washington. Do you have any evidence of epigenetic transgenerational effects from exposure to arsenic? And this too is a great question and a topic of much research within the Superfund research program here at Columbia, at NYU, and elsewhere. Certainly, as of now, we know that arsenic is associated, even prenatal exposure, both in animal models and in newborns in Bangladesh, arsenic exposure is associated with changes in DNA methylation. And I refer you to a paper by Pilsner, is the last author, Pilsner. We can post this if somebody reminds me. It's in PLOS One, year 2000, just some months ago, looking at epigenetic changes in cord blood in Bangladesh. And I know that at NYU, in collaboration with Max Costa, in collaboration with Mary Gamble here at Columbia, are working on looking at histone modifications. That's not published. I think there'll be two posters at Monday's meeting in North Carolina, the Superfund Research annual meeting in North Carolina. There will be posters on this topic, but that's as much as I can tell you now. Is there another question on the phone? Okay. I should look at the clock. I think we are running a bit over, so I'm going to assure you that the questions that remaining will be emailed to the appropriate speakers, whether it's these that I have now or later. And I'm going to begin to introduce our second presentation for today, a presentation by Dr. Eduardo Saez, who's an SRP researcher from the University of Arizona Superfund Research Center. Eduardo Saez is a distinguished professor in the Department of Chemical and Environmental Engineering at the University of Arizona. He's from Venezuela, where he earned a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering from Simon Bolivar University. He subsequently earned MS and PhD degrees in Chemical Engineering from UC Davis. He worked as a faculty member at Simon Bolivar University and then at North Carolina State, before joining the University of Arizona in 1998. He's been a visiting scholar in the Department of Physics in Bristol University in the UK and at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Richland, Washington. Dr. Saya's research deals with the fate, transport, and treatment of trace contaminants in water sources, including the use of solar energy to drive advanced oxidation, of contaminants in water resources. He's also interested in the transport of metal and metalloid contaminants in wind-blown dust from mining operations in arid and semi-arid environments. His research includes monitoring, analysis, and modeling of arsenic and lead transport in mining field sites in Arizona and in Australia. Dr. Sayers, please.
Thank you. My presentation starts on slide 28, and we're going to be talking about different route of transport. Here we are concerned with the atmospheric transport of arsenic in the form of dust and aerosol particles, and we're going to be looking as well as other metal and metalloid contaminants. Now, the focus of this presentation is going to be on the transport of these contaminants from mining operations, and in the in slide 28, you can see a picture of three of the sites that we have sampled that we're going to be talking about in detail. Moving on to slide 29, why are we concerned with dust and aerosol from mining operations? These are the possibilities. Crushing, grinding, and mine tailings management puts dust in the air, essentially what we call coarse particles. These are particles of size greater than 2.5 microns. And the tau on that slide refers to a sort of an average residence time in the atmosphere. These particles can remain in the atmosphere for minutes to hours, essentially. Then a second source is smelting, refining, and everything that produces a vapor that can contain these contaminants. These particles are emitted in the ultrafine range, that is, particles below 0.1 microns, and those particles don't survive in the atmosphere very long because essentially they condense and coalesce and coagulate, and they form particles in what's called the accumulation range between 0.1 and 2.5 microns, which can remain in the environment for about 10 days. The next slide, slide 30, shows sort of a qualitative assessment of why we are concerned about particles originating by mining operations. And it's a little busy, but essentially the dotted line that starts horizontal and then drops represents by particle size the distance traveled in the environment. So the bigger the particles, the shorter the distance that they're going to travel. The concentration that you see by particle size in mining operations is the dotted blue line with the two maxima, the highest maxima on the plot, and that kind of distribution, I'm going to show you experimental data in a moment, or field data rather, that shows that kind of distribution. It is interesting to point out, though, if you look now at the curve with the minimum, that represents the deposition efficiency in the human respiratory system. So essentially, where you find particles with high concentration of contaminants, which is in that range around 0.2, 0.3 microns, is where the deposition efficiency is the lowest. Even so, because the concentrations can be elevated, you have a sort of a qualitative red curve there, which would represent, again, qualitatively human exposure. Moving to slide 31, briefly I would like to tell you the methods by which we sample dust and aerosol in the field. One of the instruments that we use is the total suspended particulate collector, which collects essentially particles of any size. The second one is the Moody, which I'm going to show you some results on. The interesting aspect about this instrument is that the positive impactor is that we can fractionate the dust in the atmosphere in 11 different bins by particle size. Then we also use dust track aerosol monitors, and the scanning mobility particle sizer, and the objective of all these pieces of equipment is just a collection of dust and aerosols. At the same time, it is important, because we're talking about atmospheric transport, to determine meteorological parameters, the wind speed and direction, temperature, and relative humidity of the air. Now, from the dust and aerosol that we collect, we determine metal and metalloid concentrations using ICP-MS after extraction from the solid with aqua regia. The next slide, slide 32, shows the field sites in which we have worked. Essentially, the contaminated sites are the interesting sites. They are Iron King, which is where an inactive copper mine exists. It's a Superfund site right now, and the most important contamination is in the presence of tailings that are heavily contaminated with arsenic and lead. A second site is Hayden and Winkelmann, which is a site where there is an active copper smelter. And then we have comparison sites that intend to measure different levels of background of these metals and metalloids in the atmosphere. One of them, as you can see, is the city of Tucson, which would be a an urban reference site for the state. Moving on to slide 33, we have also sampled at two locations in Australia, Mount Isa and Port Perry, where active smelters that produce copper and lead especially exist. And we have used the city of Sydney as a sort of a background. Of course, Sydney is very far away from Mount Isa and Port Perry, so this is more sort of a reference measurement. Moving on to slide 34, slide 34 presents results of our sampling at the Hayden site. Again, let me remind you that there's an active smelter there, and there is quite an extensive mine tailings also in the area. Now, what this plot shows is the average concentration over a sampling period of 1 year. These were a number of sampling events that were averaged. The left vertical axis is the concentration of arsenic in the air in nanograms per cubic meter, and the right on the left axis also cadmium, and the right axis represents the lead concentration. And one interesting thing about these results, you can see the big error bars. That is because of the fluctuations of the different sampling events. But essentially, if you look at individual sampling events, you will see curves that have the characteristic that this plot has, that there is a bimodal distribution in the presence of the contaminants, so specifically arsenic and lead. So you can see that at 0.32 microns, which is precisely that accumulation mode that I was telling you about, you get a maximum concentration, and then there is another maximum at around 6.2 to 9.9 microns. Now, our initial hypothesis here was that these very small particles, 0.3 microns and below, are particles that come from the condensation of vapors, and so the origin of these particles would be smelting operations, essentially, whereas the bigger particles could either be wind-blown dust coming from tailings, or, as I will show you later, these could be actually part of the background. Moving to slide 35, one of the ways that we have used to determine where the contamination comes from in the samples that I just showed you is by using lead isotope analysis. And what I'm showing here is the a plot of ratio of lead concentrations with atomic mass 208 to 206, that's the vertical axis, and the horizontal axis is the ratio of lead concentrations with atomic mass 207 to 206. And this is the standard way that is used in the literature to represent lead isotopic composition. And you can see clearly, and this is the data from the Hayden site, you can see clearly that there is a distinction between the fine particles and the coarse particles. If we go to the next slide, We also did some sampling where the samples were taken only when the wind was directly blowing from the smelter to the sampling site. And when we do that, you can see that coarse and fine particles are in the same range where the fine particles were in the previous slide. So what this means is that essentially when the wind is blowing from the smelter, all the contamination is coming from the smelter, and it's present in fine particles, but it's also present in coarse particles, actually, because of deposition of fine particles onto coarse particles. Now, the interesting thing is, where did then the other signature, the lower signature, come from? And if you go to the next slide, you can see that when we do a late isotope analysis of dust and aerosol from Tucson, we get exactly, at the coarse and fine ranges, we get exactly the same signature that we had the first time. So essentially, what this shows us is, well, first, that lead isotope analysis can be used at least qualitatively to assess source apportionment of these contaminants, but also that essentially the contamination that we're measuring in the Hayden site is from smelting vapors, where this second signature represents background probably for Arizona. We also at the Hayden site took samples, and now I'm moving to slide 38, took samples of the soil as a function of distance from the smelter, and this is just the pictures showing how the samples were taken. Samples were taken as a function of depth, down to depths of 1 meter. And in the next slide, the next few slides, starting on slide 39, I'm going to show you the concentration of arsenic and lead and cadmium in the soil as a function of distance from the smelter and as a function of depth. In slide 39, if you look to your lower left, the lower left corner of the slide, you can see a kind of a dark shadow there. That's actually the shadow of the stack. So that's the region where the smelter is located. And the concentrations that you're seeing there in parts per million represent concentrations of the soil at the first pin that is surrounded by the red circle, which is about 0.2 miles from the smelter. And you can see that the lead concentration is actually more or less independent of depth. The bars increase in depth toward the right. The number in parentheses is the depth of the soil sample in centimeters. And the arsenic concentration at about between 50 and 100 ppm is more or less stable. We think that we don't see a definite profile here because the deposition on this soil has been occurring for many years. Now, if you move to slide 39, you can see that going on to the next sampling site at 0.8 miles from the smelter, the concentrations have decreased considerably. And on slide 41, you see that 2.5 miles from the smelter, the concentrations are very, very low comparatively. All these plots are, of course, on the same scale. So essentially what this is showing us is that there is a pattern of contamination that is distributed around the smelting site, but essentially if you get far away from the smelter, you return to what we would consider the background, essentially. Moving on to slide 42, here I'm showing you exactly the same results as before, the same sampling as before using the Moody sampler, but for a single measurement in Mount Isa, Australia. Now, again, you are seeing there the arsenic concentrations and lead concentrations by particle size in wind-blown dust and aerosol. And essentially, it's interesting to see that the maximum concentrations are occurring in the same particle size range. The peak is not the same for the two components, arsenic and lead, but we believe that this might be caused by the fact that lead might have more than one source, essentially. The the little windrows that you see as an inset in the plot represents the wind direction. And incidentally, the wind direction for this particular sampling wasn't directly from the smelting site, and still the concentrations of arsenic and lead in the air on the dust and aerosol are appreciable. So a conclusion from this is that essentially the distribution by particle size is not going to look that different when you look at different sites, as long as they have a composition in the ore that contains these contaminants, specifically arsenic and lead. The next slide shows similar results for another sampling site in Australia, Port Pirie, and this is slide 43. And you can see once again a distribution where you get the maximum in the 0.3 to 0.5 micron size range. But in this particular case, for the case of lead, you see a really strong bimodal distribution with a very high maximum at 9.9 microns. And here, this is just, again, one sampling event. Our hypothesis is that this high concentration of lead is coming from crushing and grinding operations of the ore, specifically. This is, by the way, a lead smelter at Port Pirie. If we go to slide 44 now, this is a sort of a summary of all the sites that we have sampled. So this shows contaminant concentration, lead and arsenic, once again, for the different sites, and there are two bars for each site, one for particles greater than 1 micron and particles less than 1 micron. So here we have divided the concentrations into fine and coarse size ranges. And notice, of course, that the vertical axis is a logarithmic scale. But when you look at the far right of the plot, Green Valley, Tucson, and Sydney, these are essentially background sites to some extent. They're not close to any mining operations, whereas the other sites, you can see always an elevated concentration of both lead and arsenic comparatively in Hayden, Port Pirie, and Mount Isa, which is a result of the results that I showed you before. And there is also here results for fine and coarse fractions from Iron King, which is a site that I'm going to be talking about in detail right now, but there is no smelter there. There is only mine tailings. Going to slide 45, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Iron King site. This is, as I mentioned, a Superfund site. There is no smelter operating currently, but there are extensive mine tailings, and you can see on the lower left a clear picture of the mine tailings pile. And even though the mine hasn't been operating since 1967, the tailings are, of course, heavily contaminated with arsenic and lead with concentrations of up to 4,000 parts per million of both arsenic and lead. And for this reason, this was listed in 2008 as a Superfund site. On slide 46, I give you an idea of what we're doing at the site. The tower that you see there is a tower with the instrumentation on top of the tailings pile, and we are measuring, we are collecting dust, we are measuring dust concentrations, and the plot in the bottom is an online measurement of concentration of dust in the air in two towers. And the different lines in each plot represent different heights in the towers. Now, I wanted to show this slide because in that plot you can see that the concentrations of dust are more or less uniform over a certain period of time. I'm covering about 3 days in this plot. But once in a while you see big peaks. And those peaks are consequences of wind gusts, essentially, that have the potential then of carrying these contaminated dust to neighboring populations. Now, one of the things that we're doing in the Iron King mine tailings, moving on to slide 47, is phytosterilization of the mine tailings. So essentially what this means is we are planting plants that can survive in the highly acidic mine tailings, but that potentially would not take up the arsenic and lead in the mine tailings. The idea of the phytosterilization, one of the ideas essentially, is to provide a canopy that would prevent the formation of or the emission of dust into the atmosphere. Slide 48 shows the project of phytosterilization, what you have in the center and the little color squares. That is a top view of the tailings pile and the lots that are going to be used and are being used for phytosterilization trials. And you can see that there are different plots, in the sense that there are plots that are going to be controls where nothing is going to be planted, and then there are plots with seeds, but with seeds and irrigation, with no seeds and irrigation, and so on and so forth. So all the possible combinations that you could use as control for the study of dust and contaminant emission. There is also a list of the plants selected. These are plants that can grow in this particular environment. And slide 49 shows the results of the first planting season, say, and you can see the evolution of that particular lot. This was an irrigated and seeded lot as a function of time during the year from June to October. And the last picture, the unamended picture, represents a lot that was irrigated as that was the other lot, but it wasn't seeded. And this was just to show that nothing would grow there, even if you have enough water. Quantification of the canopy cover is in the table that you see here, but I think that the visual is a better representation of what is going on. Going on to slide 50, the objective, one of the objectives of all these, of course, was to see if essentially phytostabilizing the tailings would result in a decrease in dust emissions. And what you have here in the y-axis is the percent decrease in PMX. There are five bars for each condition that you see there, and each represents different particle sizes. So PM1 are particles below 1 micron, PM2.5 below 2.5 microns, and so on, and TSP is total suspended particulate. Now, this is percent decrease in the dust concentration in the atmosphere upwind to downwind of the plot. So this is essentially the percent decrease in the dust in the atmosphere as the wind blows over the plot. Now, I want to call your attention to the control plot on the right. The control plot, essentially, as I said before, was being irrigated. So when wind carries dust into it, the dust deposits, but there is no dust generated because essentially the soil is moist. So what you get is a decrease in the particles of about between 20 and 30%. And then the other two parts of the plot present the percent decrease in dust concentration when you have sparse vegetation and dense vegetation. And you can see that even though these are preliminary results, there seems to be an improvement with respect to a simple irrigated plot when you have vegetation present. There is one exception there, sparse vegetation. The total suspended particulate doesn't decrease as much as in the control. We cannot explain that at this point, but as I said before, these are just preliminary results. So this would be the objective, to quantify how much dust the vegetation can capture. Next, slide 51, I want to show you some preliminary results that we've obtained in doing modeling of transport of particulates and eventually contaminants from the mine tailings. And what you see here, the gray area, is a representation of the mine tailings. And we're using computational fluid dynamic modeling. And one of the things, the first thing that we do, of course, is to simulate the wind speeds. And what you have there is the representation of the wind speeds as velocity vectors. What I just want to point out about this plot is that the simulation shows, of course, that your velocity decreases towards the surface of the mine tailings as you get into the boundary layer, and then it increases with the height. But essentially, the calculation here is of the three-dimensional velocity field of the wind. In slide 52, introduces the results of the simulation that I'm going to show you in the next few slides. Essentially, what we have done here is we have simulated with that realistic wind profile that we obtained from CFD, the plume of a conservative tracer that is emitted from the mine tailings. So what I'm going to show you is, you see the mine tailings clearly delineated there. I'm going to show you what happens when a wind gust puts a puff of contaminant, say, into the air when you have a prevailing wind from the west, that is from the left side of the screen. And on the right of the tailings, you can see the proximity of the city of Humboldt to the mine tailings. And I'm going to show you what our simulations show about the distribution and spread of this plume. So if you go through the next slides 53 to 57 in sequence, what you're going to see is the spread of that plume from the mine tailings to the right. The red line there, the red vertical line in the square on the upper part of the plot, is a line that crosses through the town of Humboldt, essentially, in this simulation. And the square on top represents the top view of the plume. And what you see at the bottom, essentially, is the distribution of the contaminants on a vertical plane as they are emitted from the tailings. So if you put that in sequence, you can see how the concentration, how the plume spreads in the direction of the town, and you can see also that there are important vertical concentration gradients, of course, because of the variations of wind speed and because of the three-dimensional nature of the simulation. The objective of all this, of course, would be to be able to predict let's say arsenic and lead could spread for a specific wind event or for sustained winds. Moving on to slide 58, the summary of what I've been telling you today, we can see that there is a high concentration or a maximum in the concentration of metals and metalloids around the fine particle size fraction, the accumulation mode, 0.3 microns. Now, as I mentioned before, these particles penetrate deep into the lung. They don't have a high collection efficiency in the lung, and the reason for this is that as you breathe them in, for that particular particle size, they cannot diffuse and deposit in the lung, and essentially you breathe them out. But 20% capture efficiency, which is what is cited at this particle size with the concentrations that we are seeing, would represent a significant exposure. And the wind-blown dust from mine tailings, this is specific to the Iron King results, leads to concentrations in the coarse particle size range. I have shown you also that lead isotope analysis can be used for source apportionment, although we still are gathering data in this regard. Phytoremediation could then decrease dust emitted from mine tailings, and finally, computational fluid dynamics can be used to model contaminant transport from the mining sources, essentially. And I just want to conclude the following slide. The final slide is I just wanted to show you a picture of something that happens around here in Arizona very often. It's a dust storm in Phoenix last year. So with this, I conclude my presentations, and I'll take questions.
Thank you, Eduardo. So we'll first go to questions on the phone. We are running a little bit long, so I think we're going to take one or two questions, and then I promise we will all get back any questions by email. Are there any questions on the phone? Okay. Hearing none, let me take a question that's posted here. Has there been any, this is Brian Carling, CH2M Hill, Philadelphia. Has there been any work done to determine what concentrations might be found in soil due to deposition?
I showed you our first measurements of concentration in the soil, the concentration of arsenic and lead that you see in the soil, with a little bit of cadmium in slides 39 and 40 mainly, are essentially, we believe, deposition from condensing smelting vapors that become particles in the accumulation size, and then they settle out of the atmosphere. Now, that's around an active smelter. Around mine tailings, and now I'm talking about the Iron King site, there have been measurements of concentrations of arsenic and lead in topsoil in the town of Humboldt and in the vicinity of the mine tailings, and the concentrations are appreciably higher than background. So the answer is yes, people are actually doing that as we speak, sampling in the vicinity of the mine tailings.
Anyone on the phone? Questions? I'll take one more from the screen here. That's Bharat Bam. The organization is Pennsylvania DEP, I believe it is, in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Referring to Eduardo's slide 32, has any study or comparison been done at power plants and cement plants generating large quantities of coal ash and cement kiln dusts?
That's a very good question. I have not seen extensive studies around cement factories or power plants, coal-fired power plants. We were actually concerned about deposits of fly ash, which could be contaminated not only with metals and metalloids of the sort we've been talking about here, but also mercury. But I'm not aware of sustained studies in the area. There are some sporadic reports in the literature about emissions of these type of contaminants from those sites, but not that many.
Okay, thank you. So with that, for now, and once again, all questions will be answered by email, let me go ahead and introduce our third presentation today, which is by Dr. Margaret Karagas, SRP researcher from the Dartmouth Toxic Metals Superfund Research Program. Professor Karagas is director of the Formative Children's Environmental Health and Disease Prevention Research Center at Dartmouth, and a project leader on the Dartmouth Superfund Research Program. She received her PhD in epidemiology from the University of Washington in 1990, after which she joined the Dartmouth faculty, where she heads the section of biostatistics and epidemiology. Her work encompasses interdisciplinary studies designed to illuminate the pathogenesis of human disease beginning in early life and impacting health throughout the lifespan. Dr. Karagas, please.
Thank you, Joe, and hello, everyone. I'm grateful for the opportunity to share some of our work and very much to the NIEHS Superfund Research Program for their many years of support for us here at Dartmouth, about 17 years now. It's amazing. And it's very nice to participate with my old friends and colleagues, and I want to thank you for the very nice photo of you, Joe, and Bill. So what I'll be talking about today builds on some of the ideas introduced in Joe's presentation. So if you will turn to the next slide, 61. Just to review, that the drinking water standards have come down over time as our knowledge of the health effects in the general population have emerged. So as we know, in 2001, the U.S. lowered the drinking water standard to 10 micrograms per liter, with some states having gone down even lower based on the NRC recommendations, such as in New Jersey. However, private wells, as Joe mentioned, are not regulated. So to the next slide, 62. And as we've heard from Eduardo, arsenic is abundant in the Earth's crust and is present in most drinking water in the world, including the U.S., and then extending that into our rural state of New Hampshire, where about 40% of the population relies on private, unregulated water, largely bedrock wells, over which 10% contain arsenic above the current MCL. And this is thought primarily to be attributed to the bedrock geology. And I've shown here a rock that shows some of the seams referred to by Joe. So moving on to 63. So what I'll touch on today is our work incorporating exposure biomarkers and integrating genetic susceptibility to cancer, and how we have extended our studies more recently to investigating the impact of in utero and early life exposures to arsenic. And so far, we have enlisted over 7,000 participants in our cancer molecular epi studies, in which we've obtained individual biomarker levels of arsenic. And this would include thousands of cancer patients, which is the advantage of our case control approach that I'll describe, and also have tested thousands of private wells. And our goal is to enlist 1,000 mother-infant pairs in our birth cohort, and we are now approaching this goal. So to the next slide, 64. We began our work studying skin cancer because dermal lesions, including premalignancies and cancer, are the classic manifestations of chronic arsenic exposure. And the skin cancers tend to be squamous cell carcinomas, which is a cell type that tends to be the more aggressive form of non-melanoma skin cancers. And although rare, they do and can metastasize and in any case require medical treatment. These lesions were first discovered among patients who were treated with a potassium arsenite solution in the late 1800s called Fowler solution, and then many decades later reported in the arsenic endemic region of the southwest of Taiwan. So the question we sought to address is, what about the more common, lower levels of exposure? We'll turn to the next slide. So we designed a population-based case control study of skin cancers. And these are malignancies that are not covered in most of the central cancer registries. So we actually had to create such a registry in New Hampshire and got the cooperation of the dermatologists, the dermatopathologists, and all the pathology practices in the state. So we have over 90% of the private practices taking part in all the central pathology laboratories in the state and bordering areas. And then we select controls from population lists that for us are the driver's licenses and Medicare records. And the interviews were usually conducted at the participant's home, and we're collecting tap water, blood, toenail clippings for arsenic and other trace elements, and we also request the original diagnostic slides and blocks for a histopathology re-review by our study pathologists and for molecular phenotyping. And in our initial studies, we found an elevated odds ratio for squamous cell carcinoma of the skin in the highest category of toenail arsenic, a twofold increase, with evidence of a dose-related increase at higher levels of exposure within our population. So to the next slide.
Slide number.
We're on slide number 66 now, please. Thank you, Joe. So more recently, there have been improved sensitivities for detecting low levels of arsenic in urine. So we began examining associations with squamous cell carcinomas of the skin and urinary arsenic partnering with the Arizona Superfund group, and we're very thankful to them. So as Joe mentioned, the inorganic arsenic undergoes methyl metabolism, and using ICP-MS, you can measure the individual arsenic species that Joe referred to. And doing this, we're beginning to see a linear dose-related association with squamous cell carcinoma and urinary arsenic, as well as with MMA, DMA, and the strongest association, at least in our preliminary analysis, appears to be with the MMA. And this work is being led by a new faculty member here, Diane Gilbert-Diamond. So our work using skin cancer as a model of arsenic-associated malignancies continues as our tools and our findings become more refined. So I ask you to stay tuned. Next slide, 67, please. So one of the ways arsenic may affect cancer risk is by altering DNA repair mechanisms. So we were looking at genetic polymorphisms and selected DNA repair genes and found that those with higher arsenic exposure were at enhanced risk of both the major types of skin cancer, basal cell carcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma, if they had a variant in the known DNA repair gene, Xeroderma pigmentosum D. And this was the work of Dr. Kate Applebaum, who's now at BU, and this was part of her PhD thesis at Harvard under the mentorship of Dr. Heather Nelson. Slide 68. So New England has high bladder cancer mortality rates shown in red and circled there on the map. And there was evidence that arsenic also caused bladder cancer in some of the highly exposed populations around the globe. So as part of our Superfund research program, we also embarked on a case control study of bladder cancer and also saw a dose response relationship between toenail arsenic concentrations and bladder cancer risk, again with increases at the highest exposure levels in our population. And this was found particularly among smokers. Slide 69. And then once more, looking for susceptibility loci for arsenic-related bladder cancer, we performed a non-synonymous coding SNP, a genome-wide kind of array, in a subset of bladder cancer cases with high and low levels of arsenic and detected two promising hits. And both of these validated in our full case control study. And what I'm showing here are the results for a polymorphism or a variant in SLC39A2, indicating with the high bars on the right, elevated odds ratios in the high arsenic group who were homozygote variants for this SLC39A2 compared to those wild type. And again, this effect was stronger among smokers. Slide 70. So we were especially interested in this gene because it's in the ZIP family of metal transporters named in plants by our colleague here, Mary Lou Guerno, who's part of our Superfund research program and is a plant geneticist. And the ZIP is short for zinc-regulated transporters and IRTs, which are major iron transporters. They're not known to transport arsenic, but arsenic is known to replace zinc in proteins. So we could speculate that perhaps that if the genotype renders cells deficient in zinc, then arsenic might more readily replace zinc in things like tumor suppressor genes, but there are some experimental studies that are needed to test this. So on to slide 71. So given our observations of potential cancer risks at these common exposure levels, I became concerned about other susceptible subgroups, including pregnant women and children being exposed to well water containing arsenic. Slide 72. So arsenic is known to pass through the placenta. such that the levels in maternal blood are similar to those in cord blood. And this was seen in Andean women and also in Bangladesh by the Columbia Superfund group, where they were able to measure the individual species and found remarkably high correlations between mother and fetal cord blood. So the next slide, as Joe mentioned, is that there's some very interesting findings that have emerged examining in utero and early life exposures. Mike Walkies and colleagues found cancers in mice exposed in utero to arsenic. And then, as Joe referred to, the epidemiologic data from Antofagasta, Chile, indicating risks of liver and lung cancers related to early life exposures. In slide 74, a pregnancy study from Thailand that's familiar to Dr. Sook and myself was supported by the Chiliborn Research Institute, and this is a photo looking up at the roof of this very exquisite research facility in Bangkok. And the cohort included women living around an old tin mine who were exposed to arsenic through their drinking water. And in the microarray analysis of selected cord bloods from pregnancies with high versus low exposure, there was evidence of altered gene expression in tumor promoter and progression pathways, as well as those involved in immune response. And this analysis was led by Dr. Rebecca Fry at University of North Carolina, with whom we're collaborating on a microarray analysis of blood samples in our own New Hampshire pregnancy cohort. On to slide 75, Joe mentioned some of the possible clinical impacts, and I'd like to highlight one of these, which is birth weight, that has a number of both short and long-term health implications, in the short term affecting outcomes such as infant mortality, and the long-term outcomes such as coronary heart disease. And in a large cohort study from Bangladesh, they had an interesting finding of a diminished birth weight in relation to arsenic, but only at the lower levels of exposure. Other studies have also found reduced birth weight in relation to in utero arsenic exposure, but to our knowledge, no studies have been done in the U.S. population. Slide 76. So as part of our Dartmouth Superfund research program, we sought to test the hypothesis that prenatal exposure to arsenic is associated with reduced birth weight, fetal growth, and gestational age in New Hampshire. And slide 77, as I mentioned, for our population, water is an important exposure route. So what we did was we began our study focusing on a region known from our previous epidemiologic work to have wells above the current MCL and some that are even above the previous standard of the 50 micron microgram per liter. And so the area that we began focusing on was around the spot that was to the lower right. And then, indeed, in this region, we found almost 1 in 5 women to have arsenic in their tap water that exceeded the MCL, which is cause for concern. And then later, we added a second region and a recruitment site where there are some wells above the MCL, and that's that second smaller circle that's about halfway up the state. A few years ago, I participated in a European Food Safety Authority panel on food sources of arsenic. And the estimated adult intake of arsenic in food was 0.13 to 0.56 micrograms per kilogram of body weight in this assessment. And the estimate for children under the age of 3 years was 2 to 3 times higher than that of adults. We concluded that for most people, diet is the main source of arsenic exposure, and overall, that dietary exposure to arsenic should be reduced. slide 79 shows the overall study design for our cohort. So we enroll women at their first prenatal visit, or they're screened at their first prenatal visit as eligible if their household is served by a private well. And then we enlist them at around 24 to 28 weeks gestation. And we determine birth weight and gestational age of the newborns from their delivery records. And as Joe mentioned, we were fortunate to get funding as a formative NIEHS, EPA, Children's Environmental Health and Disease Prevention Center, which allowed us to collect some additional information on diet and infection, to analyze biologic samples on infants, and to follow up the kids. And so far, we've had good participation rates, and of those who do enroll, most provide a urine and household water sample and dietary information. Slide 80, our data on our cohort we published last year on rice consumption and urinary arsenic concentrations with Diane Gilbert Diamond and Kathy Cottingham as the first authors. And you can see here in the yellow bars that urinary arsenic concentrations were higher among women who reported eating rice compared to those who did not report eating rice in the 2 days prior to urine collection. And we picked this time window because arsenic is excreted in about 2 days of ingestion. And on slide 81, you can see on the right side of the curve the water relationship with urinary arsenic. And you can see that the amount of arsenic consumed from water, as well as on the left, the amount of rice consumed related to urinary arsenic concentrations. And from our model, we estimated that eating 1 cup of cooked rice in arsenic-free water was equivalent to drinking 2 liters per day of 10 microgram per liter arsenic. And then on slide 82, after that, we published a market basket survey indicating elevated arsenic concentrations in some formulas, in particular those containing brown rice syrup. And in our most recent paper published this month in Environmental Health Perspectives, this is based on analysis of NGAMES data performed by Matt Davis, a PhD student here in my lab. And this analysis includes over 2,000 kids with urinary arsenic and 24-hour recall data. And Matt had to figure out, analyze the data and figure out the number of grams of rice the foods the kids ate. And these results are remarkably similar to what we found in pregnant women, both in kids between the ages of 6 and 11.
You're now, excuse me,
sorry.
Slide 84.
I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah.
So this is the histogram, thank you, Joe, showing the yellow bars again being higher among the kids who consumed rice compared to the blue bars of the kids that did not report eating rice in the 24 hours prior to their urine collection. I wanted to summarize on slide 85 that there are an increasing number of studies examining low levels of arsenic exposure. And this table is from the 2009 EFSA report that lists the studies that were considered for determining a benchmark dose. And no one study or value was chosen, but rather a range of studies and a range of values. And the studies included were dermal lesions and cancer from which dose response could be estimated. And then in my final slide, content slide, I wanted to just emphasize that we need to study arsenic's impact on a broad range of health outcomes, including infection and immunity. And this is a quote from a commentary I wrote on the Columbia Group's Lancet paper on mortality in Bangladesh that Joe mentioned, that was a really just, I think, a landmark study, just really phenomenal work that's being done there. But I did want to say that childhood infections are an important source of morbidity and mortality worldwide, including in the United States. And that the immune system is one of the major pathways perturbed by arsenic. So as an epidemiologist, our work certainly is not yet done. And I am grateful to the many who have collaborated with us. Just some of the names are shown on slide 87. Just some of the investigators at the many universities, and we also have many others, including all of our participants and our very dedicated and talented staff members on our project. And I want to express again my gratitude to NIEHS and the Superfund Research Program for supporting our work and certainly making my career studying the health impacts of arsenic an enjoyable and fulfilling one. And I want to thank everyone for joining, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Margaret. If I may, before we open the question and answer session to all three presenters, I want to make sure everyone is aware of the links page. If we can go to slide 88. On the links page, we've assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form, as Bill Sook mentioned, and we really do ask that you consider filling this out, and we do look at comments and try to improve the content and delivery of these webinars. Links to the additional resources page and the feedback form can be found on the last slide of the presentation, that's slide 89. One more announcement before we open up to questions. The next webinar in this series will be on November 5th from 2 to 4 p.m. Registration information will be posted on the SRP Risk e-Learning webpage as soon as it's available and will also be emailed to the mailing list. Okay, I'll now open the question and answer period for Dr. Karagas, or for that matter, if there are any questions for any the other two speakers. First, go to the phones. Are there any questions on the phone? And you would have to hit star 7 to speak. If not, I have a number of questions that have been emailed in. Margaret, Lori Moreau, Woodward and Curran, Portland, Maine, is asking, is bottled water regulated for arsenic? Margaret?
Yeah. Does anyone know about bottled water, Joe?
I don't. Shame on us. I do not know the answer to that.
I think I would have to get back on the precise answer. I do know some bottled waters do report the levels, but that is a good question, and we'll follow up with you.
Another question, Martha Hankins, Washington Department of Ecology. Oops, my screen just moved. Just one second. Are you aware of adverse neurobehavioral effects from early life exposure and in utero exposure to arsenic? I'll try this one. We have studied six-year-old children in Bangladesh, and have demonstrated adverse effects on intelligence, essentially, and other work in slightly older children and motor function. These children were certainly exposed in utero and were likely, some of them, also exposed after birth, although many of the mothers, we began an education program in 2000 along with recruitment, and so many of the mothers actually switched to low arsenic wells after the birth of child. So I don't think we can say definitively it's just prenatal exposure. We actually have an ongoing study now in Bangladesh that I don't have time to describe, but we do have a group who were exposed in utero and not thereafter, and are exploring exactly these issues, as well as non-malignant respiratory disease. Any questions on the phone? So, this
Hi
is
there. This is Stephanie from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. What is it about rice that makes it have a higher arsenic exposure pathway, and or is there a way to avoid rice or avoid the arsenic contamination in rice for populations with higher rice content in their diet?
Margaret?
Yeah, so you're asking, you know, some really good questions about rice. Yeah, rice is a plant that does take up arsenic because some of the transporters that involved in silica transport take up rice, arsenic into the rice grain. And we're really, that's part of our Superfund research program is to understand the transport of arsenic into the rice grain. It's a whole plant genetic study that's being conducted and led by Mary Lou Guerno here. So rice is highly variable. So it's going to depend on the soil in which it's grown, and the different cultivars and the species are different in how they take up rice. So it's very hard to just say a specific recommendation, and certainly our study wasn't designed to make any kind of specific recommendations. But I think this is what we're seeing, is that there is an attention now to try to monitor some of the products. You might have seen there was a Consumer Report that tested a bunch of rice products, and also the FDA is conducting a very large survey testing a bunch of products. So I think the answer to your question is going to is beginning to emerge. And we should be getting a lot more data on this soon.
If I could chip in here, it turns out that the arsenic concentration of rice varies widely and by country, and for that matter by region. And it turns out that the United States rice has the highest arsenic concentration. Why is that? Because arsenical pesticides were used in the southern states and sprayed on cotton back when we grew cotton in the south to address the boll weevil problem. And as a result, in the southern United States, where we now grow rice, there are very high soil, relatively high soil arsenic concentrations. And in fact, when southerners began to grow rice, they couldn't get a good crop. The plant would grow, but it wouldn't develop the rice grains. And this is what botanists call a disease called straight head disease. And so the U.S. Department of Agriculture actually had a campaign to develop an arsenic-resistant strain of rice. And that is likely why the U.S. rice grown where arsenical pesticides were applied, that's likely why we have relatively high arsenic rice. And I'm told by those who do this that Italian rice is the lowest rice, the lowest arsenic concentration. We have a question here from Annette Kirshner at NIEHS. Hi, Annette. Margaret, for slide 81, is there a difference between white rice and brown rice?
Slide 81. So in our study, let me just check and see what slide we're on. Oh, the slide where we looked at urinary arsenic excretion in pregnant women, we did not differentiate between brown rice and white rice, which is a very good question and something that we are looking at now. In terms of the research on detecting arsenic in the rice grain, that the casing around the rice, which is taken off to make white rice, the embryo will have concentrations of arsenic, which is why in the next slide, when we looked at the concentrations in some food products, those containing brown rice, and in particular brown rice syrup, had the higher concentrations. So one would hypothesize that you would see higher concentrations in brown rice than in white rice.
I just received an answer to the bottled water question. Meredith Golden here at Columbia emails me that in June 2005, FDA issued a final rule that amended its bottled water quality standard regulations. Basically, bottled water has to achieve the same MCL for arsenic as for public drinking water. So that obviously means that the bottlers must meet the 10 ppb standard. I have a question for Eduardo Saez from, forgive me if I mispronounce your name, Minghui Jiu, University of Kentucky, Lexington. Very impressive work, Dr. Saez. I wonder if the plants that are used for the metal stabilization, will you continue to take in heavy metals and how to deal with those plants afterwards?
Well, thank you. As I mentioned, the plants, the idea would be to select plants that would uptake a minimal amount of arsenic and lead in this particular case, but we really don't know how in the long term they're going to be uptaking this. So we are actually right now sampling shoots and trunks and leaves of the first crop to try to assess that. That is one point, is the direct uptake by the plants of the metals and metalloids from the soil. The other point is actually the dust intercepted by the plants that presumably is going to deposit maybe on the leaves and the top of the plants. We're also sampling that to see how much of that is not absorbed by the plant but retained by the leaves. I hope that answers your question.
Okay. Any more questions on the phone? Here's a question from Ray Kaminsky, ACOM, San Jose. I guess it's for you, Margaret. Any comments about the current news of arsenic in cereal in the United States? Is this perhaps referring to Consumer Reports?
I'm assuming that's rice cereal. I'm not sure what the exact question is. Can you repeat it, Joe?
Sure. Any comments about the current news of arsenic in cereal in the United States?
Well, if he's referring to rice cereal, I think that is something that...
The baby cereals?
Yeah, those kinds of cereals. And that is something that we are investigating as part of our project. So we are concerned about rice and rice products and rice cereals and, you know, wanting to know how much is being consumed, you know, how much arsenic is being consumed through this exposure route and the potential health effects. So I think it's a good issue to bring up.
Okay. Here's a question for me, and I'm going to take it because I think it needs clarification. Jimmy Sparrow, Cal EPA, thank you for a great presentation, Dr. Graziano's presentation shows the genetic variation in arsenic methylation. Could you discuss the source of genetic noise? Could we do a better job of estimating risk of arsenic exposure if we routinely incorporated genetic markers of arsenic metabolism and stratified risk by methylation status? Let me take that first. Actually, the wide variation in arsenic methylation is in very small part due to genetic variation and in much larger part due to nutrition and diet. So to mention the genetics, we have published a paper maybe a year ago in PLOS Genetics, which identified polymorphisms in the arsenic methyltransferase gene and in the vicinity of that gene that are associated with poor arsenic methylation and an increased risk for skin lesions. However, those polymorphisms are very rare. The larger picture of variation in methylation has to do with diet, and here we have explored, you have to ask, well, where do methyl groups come from? And in all of biochemistry, there's a single methyl donor. We methylate many things, DNA and so forth. The single methyl donor is an activated form of the amino acid methionine, it's S-adenosyl methionine. And if you look at what's required to synthesize that universal methyl donor, the principal starting ingredient is folate, one of the B vitamins. And so Dr. Mary Gamble up in the Columbia Superfund program has a series of works demonstrating that the poor methylators tend to be people who are deficient in folate. And in fact, she did a randomized placebo-controlled trial. If you supplement people who, and we did show that people who are folate deficient are poor methylators. And if you supplement them, they become good methylators. And when they become good methylators, you see an increase in urinary arsenic excretion. Why? Because the dimethyl form is more readily eliminated by the kidney and has a short half-life. And you see a decline in blood arsenic. In fact, she has a much more expansive work, again funded by, in this case, an R01 from NIEHS, looking at other dietary means. The other two major sources of methyl groups in the diet happen to be choline and betaine. And I mentioned arsenicholine, arsenobetaine. Unfortunately, humans cannot make arsenicholine and arsenobetaine, but those two substances, choline and betaine, are additional dietary sources of methyl groups. So I hope that's clarified that question. Secondly, should we be discussing non-cancer effects in more detail? In my opinion, absolutely yes. I think what we've learned in the past 10, 12 years is that the chronic diseases, the non-cancer chronic diseases, are a big part of the pathology with arsenic exposure. Are there any other questions from the phone? On the phone. Here's another question, Eduardo. Octavio Melo, retired, Ottawa, Canada. How would the air sampling techniques you described be modified to study a site where smelting operations have long stopped, but exposed tailings and contaminated soil are still present, and remediation activities, including heavy equipment use, are planned?
Okay. The sampling, actually the site, the type of site that you're describing is similar to the Iron King site, even though there is no more processing or motion of the deposited ore. But essentially, the important point here would be to monitor the contaminants by particle size distribution. So any kind of sampler that you can use in which you can separate the dust and aerosol in the air in terms of particle size would be adequate for that kind of sampling. The other thing is to be aware of wind direction and speed in relation of the contaminated site with respect to the sampler location, and also of relative humidity, for example, of the air, because that might affect dust fluxes picked up by wind, essentially.
Okay. Any questions on the phone? I have more here. If we could go on for a couple, just a couple of minutes. Several questions from Bharat Baum, Pennsylvania DEP. Since rice is a staple diet for people in the countries listed with high arsenic in soil, and for example, South Asia, is this a significant factor or a significant component of exposure? I think I'll try this one. I think Margaret pointed out that in areas where water arsenic is low, diet plays a significant role in terms of the total dose of daily arsenic intake. But in contrary, in areas where water arsenic is quite high, the contribution of rice is not quite as significant. Nevertheless, we just had a visit from a Professor Giri from West Bengal, India, who is doing a rather informative study addressing exactly this question, and I think you can look for a publication that will come perhaps in Nature Geoscience, where one thing I can tell you, the folks in West Bengal consume 450 grams of rice per day, and so you might imagine that this could play a significant role. And he's done an elegant experiment that is looking at that contribution of that in the overall picture. So his last name is Giri, G-I-R-I, and I think you can look for that publication coming. Another question from the same gentleman, good methylator versus poor methylator, does this refer to kidney function? And here the answer is no. Briefly, we have looked into that quite extensively, and this is not the case. Any questions on the phone? Okay, here's a question. Carl Steinman, E&E Incorporated, Chicago, Illinois. Why are lead-207, Eduardo, and lead-208 enriched in smelter emissions relative to background sources?
That is actually a question that we grappled with because we thought that it would be the processing that would change the isotope ratios, but we don't think so. We don't think that what we're seeing is a product of the processing. We think that what we're seeing is the characteristic ratios of the ore that is used in processing, because our second signature essentially was background, was not directly from the ore. So I cannot say this with 100% certainty, but we don't think that the processing is going to affect the ratios. If you look at, for example, the relative volatilities of the different isotopes, the differences are not high enough to give a variation in the ratios. We did a back-of-the-envelope calculation on that. So the answer is basically, it's just a distinctive of the ore, essentially.
I see. So we do have some additional questions. My concern in responding to them at this point is that some people may have had to sign off. So at this point, I'm going to thank our presenters, and we will respond to all questions by email. I'd like to thank Dr. Eduardo Saez and Margaret Caragas for their time preparing and for sharing the presentations with us today. I certainly want to thank the audience. This webinar was oversubscribed, and I know that the organizers went out of their way to try to expand the capacity for those who were interested. So with that, I thank you for your participation and remind you there's another webinar on November 5th. Okay. Thanks all.